Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Noir at the Bar live from Tampa. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're going to start off the show right now by saying thank you to Eric Campbell from Down and Out Books for sponsoring this terrific program, the first one in Tampa history, hopefully the first of many more. And I'm going to introduce you to your MC for tonight, best-selling author Jeffrey Hess. Jeff, take it away.
Great to see you all. I appreciate you being here. This is the first ever Noir at the Bar in Tampa, and that's kind of a big deal for us. It's a great opportunity to see some of the best writers in the crime writing business, and it's a big deal for Tampa because we do have a huge crime past here in Tampa. It started probably at time immemorial, but the big time I remember is learning about was in the 20s. When the Italians came over and they started with like the Capocantes and the Salazos, and it's been a huge issue in the Tampa history, but we're not here for a history lesson, we're here for a fiction lesson from some great writers. First of all, I wanted to thank our hosts for this evening, Pam Stack from Authors on the Air. Hello, I'm Eric Campbell from Down and Out Books. And a huge thanks to Panini's Bar and Grill for setting us up at this great venue for an event like this. It's perfect weather for it, halfway inside, halfway outside. And so we appreciate that and all their attention. And so for a little bit of background, for those who might not know, my name is Jeff Hess. I do live here in Tampa, and as I said, this is the first ever Noir at the Bar in Tampa. But that Noir at the Bar, for those who aren't familiar, it is something that started in 2008 back in Philadelphia with a guy named Pete Rozovsky, who started the first one there. And it's not so much an organization, but kind of a concept. Again, it's an opportunity for crime writers to share their work and for readers to have an opportunity to listen to these writers read their work aloud. And so it's also an opportunity to have a drink or 10. Nobody judges, so help yourself. Just remember, it is on your own dime. But anyway, let's see what I know. So tonight we have five great writers, or four great writers and me. So we have Don Bruns is here tonight. Terry Lynn Coop. I have myself, like I said, I'll be reading a little bit. We also have left down in the back, we will have you removed. We also have Seth Post.
Yay!
And we have Eric Pruitt as well.
Yay, Eric!
So, with all that said, enough foreplay, let's get cracking, right? So, we'll start with our first presenter, who's going to be Don Bruns. We have a short introduction to Don. Don Bruns is an award-winning novelist, songwriter, musician, and advertising executive who lives in Sarasota. He is the author of The Lesser and More, a mixed-ever Caribbean mystery series, and two previous Quentin Archer mysteries. Can't read my own writing. So let's give it up for Don.
Thank you. In all transparency, Eric said, we will start with you to set the bar low so everyone can rise up.
No.
The reason that it's done in a bar is because writers notoriously drink while they're writing. You should drink while you're reading. So that's kind of what we do. My name is Don Bruns, and I have three series, and the most current is a New Orleans series with a homicide cop and a voodoo queen, and I will be reading from the first book called Cash in Bones. My first series was Terra B, comedian series and entertainment journalist who covers the entertainment industry and gets to the underbelly of what's going on. And he writes for Rolling Stone and a number of other magazines. And it's Jamaica Blue, Barbados Heat, South Beach Shakedown, St. Bart's Breakdown, and Bahama Burnout. I had to go to each one of those places to do research. Writing is not always a lot of fun, you see. You have to go. So I did go to those islands, and I spent a week on each of them. And the first island that really I found a lot of stuff that I didn't expect was St. Bart's. Now, St. Bart's is a story about a Phil Spector kind of a character who drunkenly kills a woman in the States. His manager shifts him over to St. Bart's to his villa over there and hides him out while they try to massage everything in the States. So when I got to St. Bart's, I met a bartender and a bouncer at one of the clubs in Vistania, and I said, I want to kill somebody, and he says, you can't do that. And I said, fictionally, I'm going to kill somebody, and he said, no, you can't do that. He said, nobody's ever been murdered in St. Bart's in the history of St. Bart's. I said, that's impossible. And he said, true, there's never been a murder, look it up. So I went to the gendarmes, and I went to the police, and I went to drug enforcement, and they all told me the same thing. So I went back to my bouncer bartender friend, I said, how is this possible? And he said, no, he said, St. Bart's has nothing to offer the world except tourism, very expensive tourism. So we don't have any murders. He said, if somebody is shot, it is self-inflicted. If somebody is knifed, they cut themselves. If somebody drowns, they couldn't swim. If somebody goes down a hill, they stumbled, they were not pushed. You could kill your mother-in-law, noon, Main Street, Gustavia, you will not get arrested. So I thought this is a great thing, and so I used it in the book. Then I went to the Bahamas for Bahama Burnout, and it's a story about a recording studio that burns to the ground, and somebody is killed in the fire, and when they rebuild it, a ghostly presence seems to be there. And so I went to the Bahamas, and I hired a taxi driver who was a former cop, and I said, I want to kill somebody. And he said, then you will be hanged. And I said, well, so you admit there's murder. He said, oh, we have a lot of murder. And he said, we hang them. And I said, well, don't you get a life sentence? Don't you get life with parole? Don't you get... He said, no. Actually, what he said was, you are hung. And I used to tell the story that way. My wife said, you know, you can be hung and not hanged. I'll explain that to you later on. So that became a part of that book. So the research is almost imperative if you want to learn. I want to do a very brief song before I do the reading about the Bahamas. I want you to picture, this is the late 1800s. And there's a gathering in the square, and the people have gathered round as they do, and they watch this. And the young man is up there, he killed his girlfriend, and in a jealous rage, and he is standing there with a rope around his neck, and a hangman is ready to pull it and have the trap door open. And he looks down the road, and it's a dusty road coming into town, and he sees a figure moving very quickly to get to the gallows. And he goes, hangman, hangman, strangle, strangle the wire. Think I've seen my love on a daily wire. This is Casting Bones. Casting Bones is the first in the voodoo. It's a homicide topping detective who hooks up with a hookup. Works with a, I understand, to the hookup means something different. works with a voodoo queen, a young lady who's a very attractive voodoo lady. And together they solve a crime. And then Severn House, my publisher, said, look, let's do a second one. So we did, and that's Thrill Kim, that's here. And now the third one, which is called No Second Chances, comes out in the UK at the end of this month. I'm very excited. And 3 months later, they come out in the States. So it's doing very well. And I want to read from this, and I want to read from the cover. If you love the crime genre, this is not just highly recommended, but mandatory. Read child. I'm reading from the book, okay? You said read from the book. This is Cash and Bones finds author Bruns at the top of this game, and I can't think of a better portrayal of the most exotic city in America, New Orleans, Jeffrey Deaver. So I guess. Let me read here, and I'll read. If people don't stop, I'll do another song. Pale, bloated body bobbed in the muddy Mississippi, bumping the seawall just down from the Creole Queen steamboat and across from the crazy Lobster Riverfront restaurant. Detective Quentin Archer peered down as the two divers maneuvered the floating corpse to a submerged rubber sling, which hung from the small crane anchored on the brick walkway. Detective Adam Strand joins in, nodding at the unfolding scene. You swallow any of that water, you're poison. That's some nasty shit, Jim. Brushing back his thick brown hair with his fingers, Archer nodded. You should see the Detroit River. Can't be any worse than that. The grinding of the winch's gears echoed off the concrete as the limp body slowly rose from its watery grave. The curious seagull swooped below as two officers in wetsuit grabbed the sling when it reached the plaza, gently lowered the body, and pulled the rubber contraption from around the corpse. Detectives, a uniformed officer motioned Archer and Strand, inviting them to view the body. A crowd had gathered in the steamboat, tourists stranding to see the grisly scene just yards from where they stood. Yellow crime scene tape wrapped the area, and uniformed officers faced the growing throng, waiting for a reporter to attempt an end run. Archer bent down, rubber gloves on, and gently rolled the body, hands in the man's rear pockets. He pulled out the wallet. Opening it, he glanced at the driver's license, then he pulled open the soap wallet pocket where the deceased kept his money. Wasn't a robbery. No. Separating the white bills, Archer said, must be a couple $100. Strand glanced at the bills. Not that anyone would miss the money much now, you know what I'm saying? Strand studied Quentin Archer for a moment. Archer frowned. He still didn't know Strand that well. Hey, it's a joke, okay? Money stays where it is. Well, someone must have got something out of it. Look at this, shot right through the eye. They studied the wound, a round hole bored through the right socket. Wasn't the water after all? Archer shook his head. Do you know a David Lerner? Judge David Lerner? Strand rose from his kneeling position and brushed in his trousers. I'm new in town, you tell me. Yeah, I know him. Works in the juvie section. Tough guy. Kids don't want to go before him. They usually get a long sentence. Didn't want to have to worry anymore. He found the driver's license, handing it to Strand. Jesus, somebody's kid didn't like his sentence. It would appear. Archer reached into the man's inside jacket pocket and pulled out his cell phone. Studying it for a moment, he handed it to Davis, another detective who was standing nearby. Davis had lab pull the SIM card, use discovery software on the computer, see if we can retrieve contacts, calls, you know the drill. A judge, Strand, looked out of the water, shaking his head. That's going to stink up the place, and we had to draw the lead on this one. There's going to be some serious pressure on this case. A department photographer snapped pictures, walking around the body, taking close-ups and long shots, every angle possible. I'm going to move down, and this is where Archer's from Detroit. He gets moved off the force. He gets forced off the force up there because he's a Serpico kind of a guy, and he has basically discovered that the Detroit top force has a drug ring, and when he tries to uncover it, they kill his wife. And so he's moved to New Orleans, which is even a more corrupt police department in Detroit. The end of the chapter reads, hey, Q, how many murders do you solve in Detroit? What's your percentage? Strange straddled the chair as Archer sat down. 50%, maybe less. There was only one that haunted him every day. One unsolved murder. Denise, his wife, the love of his life. One of the reasons he left Detroit. Well, we've got an impressive record here, Strand said. Highest murder rate per capita. And last year we solved about 22%. Maybe with you on board, our percentage goes up. Brown, drumming his fingers on the table. He had to solve Denise's murder, so his track record wasn't that good. But to be fair, he hadn't given up trying.
So our next reader is Terry Lynn Coop. Terry Lynn Coop is a recovering lawyer who sold antiques by day, writes by night, and geeks out the rest of the time. Her first novel, Devil's Deal, won the 2013 Claymore Award at the Killer National Conference. Terry experiments and writes across genres, including Salt, set in the dystopian post-apocalyptic world of Sand by Hugh Howey, and Burning Kansas, a pulp-style historical romance from the time of Lee in Kansas. Anthology contributions include Just to Watch Them Die, crime fiction inspired by music of Johnny Cash, Betrayed, fiction about crime survivors, The Battle Space, military fiction anthology, and the spooky No Rest for the Wicked collection. She is also the host of the multi-genre podcast, The Blue Plate Special, where authors are always on the menu. The Blue Plate Special is part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. So let's welcome Terry.
Hey, there's nothing left of spinning now. No, I just want to say I started out, I've been a criminal defense attorney for about 13 years. So some of pretty much everything that I write is going to have something in it that I've seen or experienced. For example, in the anthology Betrayed, my story Legal Aid, everything in it happened, up to either myself or to a client. And in my novel Devil's Deal, Juliana Martin shows up to work one day and finds that the feds have raided the family law firm. Luckily, that one has never happened. But I'm out here from Kansas, and I want to thank everyone, Eric and Pam, for the warm welcome. The story I'm going to read tonight is actually my contribution in the Johnny Cash anthology, which everyone who wrote in it chose a song, and then you wrote an inspiration from it. I chose Man in Black, and the justification on that one is the line from the song where he says, until there is justice, we'll never see bright colors on my back. I hate elevators. The idea of locking myself in a soundproof metal box kept aloft by cables is absurd. However, since my knees lack 20 flights of stairs, even less, when the door slid open, I stepped inside and pressed my back to the mirror lining the rear of the car. That's an extra step, but if I need to escape the confined space, I can keep an eye on my fellow passengers. A small monitor embedded in the wall over the control panel proclaimed the elevator news network. And cut to a scene of a street protest, complete with signs and chants. There ought to be a law. The voice didn't match the man. The accent said downtown, but the suit had an uptown air. Nice, close weave wool, muted colors, and a cut that worked on his large frame. A closer inspection, though, the edges of the lapels and pockets were worn and shiny, indicating many homegrown or low-rent cleaner ironing jobs. The years have taught me to look past the surface and concentrate on the details. This probably was one nice suit, maybe to see his lawyer or his real estate agent. But his tone demanded an answer. I don't know. We have plenty of laws. Some days it seems like we have more than we need. Yeah, but this ain't right. These shit-bag judges are letting scum walk right and left on technicality. Oh, is that what the protest is about? Yeah, they're calling for all the judges to be impeached. So the perverts they're free and should all be frying instead of eating steak. Well, I heard something about that mess. It's terrible. It seems like there's no justice anymore. Sam Primo's got all the rights. Nobody cares about the victim. I'm not so sure about that. The elevator ding reminded me of the duty to participate in any more conversation. A beefy hand held the door open while he motioned for me to exit. Despite my mood, I had to smile at the unexpected courtesy. This city never ceases to surprise me. Two bus rides later, I grabbed a cup of coffee in a busy Starbucks, and I cashed the ski mask in the men's room trash. A place like this changes out the bags often, and tomorrow's trash day. And since it's a nice afternoon, I bought a bag of buttered popcorn from a push cart and smeared the greasy kernels all over the black casting gloves as they fed the pigeons. After a quick stop by an overflowing park dumpster to toss the leather gloves wrapped in a red striped bag, I was down to the membrane, thin surgical ones, that I always wore when I was performing the internet. Those went inside out into the most fetid storm sewer I could find. Locard's principle was in full force. The leather might have the Aaron's blood, and the latex might have my genetic markers, but never in the same place at the same time. My prints were on file, but not my DNA. No one has ever died of an overabundance of caution. Calm spread through me as sunset highlighted the churning water behind the ferry. It's not only beautiful, but critical to my next task. We are not crepuscular animals. Our eyesight is poorer at dusk, and the day's fatigue is settling in the duller curiosity. The other passengers didn't disappoint. Every pair of eyes was locked on the screen of the phone they each had pointed at the last pink and purple clouds spanning the horizon. I searched in my shirt cuff, and the knife slipped into the dark water. I bought three from a street hawker, and this was the last one. For $10 each, I got a solid no-name knockoff of my favorite 4-inch shrewd six-blade tactical knife. And Tonto's are the perfect shape for penetrating the spinal cord in the sweet spot between C1 and C2. And the six-blade isn't prone to breaking if my aim is off-center. And although the cheap steel would have never held an edge, I only needed it to be sharp once. The gentle bump of the boat meeting the dock reminded me that I had one more thing to do before wrapping up my errand. When I got to the parking lot, I extracted the plastic bag package from my vest pocket. The throwaway phone still had the clear vinyl stickers over the screen and keypad. Even so, I wrapped it in a handkerchief before I punched the three numbers. This is 911. What's your emergency? I intoned the address and hung up. Tying off the back panel, I extracted the SIM card and battery. It was about 5 blocks to where I left my car. Along the way, the phone and the battery found their way into 2 separate trash cans. The card would meet the heel of my boot after spending some time on the barbecue grill. The decision to make the call came easy. It was Friday before a holiday, and a good chance that my errand wouldn't be discovered until Tuesday. By then, the foulness would be well underway. A body in a warm, closed office decomposes at an alarming rate. And it's not the fault of the police and paramedics or the minimum wage workers who'd be forced to clean it up. And the single puncture wound would be more visible than fresh flesh, my signature. That means it's time to change it. One body is an anomaly. 2 are a puzzle. 3 are a pattern. Falling into a pattern invites laziness and mistakes, even by a professional. On the flip side, anything that falls outside the pattern is dismissed. So I'll get at least one free one in the next round. +3 is just a good round number. The hot shower mixed well with the cold bourbon. 2 handfuls of dish soap. Scrub most of the temporary black dye out of my hair. And a cheap over-the-counter product put the gray streaks back where they belong. All my clothes, right down the dessert store booth, went into bags for disposal. I always enjoy coming back to myself after an errand. It's a rebirth of sorts. The steak sizzling in my favorite cast iron frying pan made me smile. It smelled like justice. The lack of media coverage on Saturday and Sunday told me that not only had my errand been found, but also that a bunch of cops were pulling overtime, hustling to hook it to the previous cases. Come Monday, since it was a holiday, I still didn't expect to see much. But at my favorite bistro, I flipped through a stack of newspapers after I asked for coffee. 1/3 of the way through, I found out I was wrong about the media. My photo, A grainy still off the security camera covered the front page of the tabloid rag. It was a bad profile, and the bill on my cap covered everything but the tip of my nose and chin, but it was still me. God, I hate it. What? I jumped when the waitress spoke. Turning, I half expected to see shock and revulsion. Instead, she gave me the same warm smile I saw week in and week out. Even though my stomach had turned into a churning volcano, I ordered my usual pastry, which was no time to freestyle. When she left, I folded back the photo and read the article. It was thin. Turns out the big guy in the dark suit on the elevator was named Albert, and he worked for the Transit Authority. But all he remembered was a tall man dressed sort of like a soldier, who kept his back to the wall and didn't have much to say. The rest of the article was Albert saying that I was a hero. One thing it was short on detail. The physical description fit about 30% of the population. After I finished the article, I paged the rest of the paper in between sips of coffee and torn off chunks of cinnamon rolls. It was acid and sawdust in my mouth, but this was all about normalcy. It's just another weekend breakfast in my favorite place. I'd like to give that guy a medal. Did you hear the whole story? The diner at the next table said as he dumped ketchup on perfectly good eggs. Nah, us doozies, sail bondsman was taking out his fees in trade. Turns out it was rough trade, if you know what I mean. Oh, you have no idea. I remember that. He killed a couple of them. About a year ago, wasn't it? I thought he was in jail. Yeah, he was until some pussy-ass judge threw out the case. That the cops didn't tie his shoes and tuck him into bed at night. Damn liberals. This is a time like this when shit got taken care of. I don't know. It looks like it got taken pretty care of pretty thoroughly to me. Knife to the neck. One cut. Probably one of those special forces guys. Well, I wish he'd speak up. A man like that would never pay for a drink again. I've heard this all before in other restaurants and bars. I hadn't heard it from someone holding a paper with my picture on the front page. It was time to get out of here. I finished the dregs of my coffee, left cash on the table, and folded the paper under my arm, cover in. As usual, my natural camouflage, salt and pepper hair with an outfit so bland and casual that it had to be expensive, didn't raise any alarms. Not a single diner gave me a second look as I left. I ambled another 15 blocks, no need to hurry, to an internet cafe that prides itself on not being nosy. Along the way, I picked up a baseball cap and some passable rip-off designer sunglasses. A lot of people hate the street vendors, but not me. I can get just about anything I need with no receipts and no hassle. At the cafe, I paid cash for 30 minutes and did some quick searching. I wasn't the only one interested in the photo. The tabloid article already had about 500 comments, most of them complimentary. The general consensus was that a rogue veteran, the sort of character that exists only in action movies and cookie-cutter thrillers, without rebalancing the scales of justice. I came to serious news outlets and didn't find much more. Someone had leaked the name of my errand and the security photo, and no real specifics. This wasn't the first time I've gotten press coverage, but this one landed closer than I like. Definitely time to change my look and my MO. It was a damn shame. That blade had been the death. The screen grayed, telling me my time was up. I'd learned what I needed to know, so there wasn't any reason to stay around. I already had my next errand picked out. Prosecutorial misconduct had led the appellate court to vacate 200 sex crime indictments. One of the defendants, in fact released by Edward Albert's shitbag judge, was out on an OR bond. This crime made the others on the list look misunderstood. But it wouldn't be today. The weather was perfect, and I still had several bags of incriminating material I needed to dump. The leaves were past their prime, so to drive along the coast was just the ticket for thinking and planning. Come Tuesday morning, climbing 7 flights of stairs, got my knee humming and my blood pumping. I hesitated at the door. Once I opened it, I was committed. You got no choice, Ace. This is your duty. Out of habit, I moved carefully to minimize the sound. But evidently, I'm not as slick as I thought, because the woman's voice cut through the air as soon as I latched the door behind me. Good morning, sir. You're late. I missed you too, Yvonne. Time and tide waits for no man, and with your vacation day and the holiday, The tide was becoming even heavier than usual. You're going to use your waders. They're lying 3 deep in the hallway. Crack the whip, my dear. Crack the whip. What can I say? You're the most popular show in town, and everyone out there has a ticket. Here, hold out your arm. I let her slip the light, little silk-lined black robe over my shoulders and adjust my tie. I knocked on the door, and a bailiff poked his head into my chamber. Your Honor, you should have been on the bench 5 minutes ago. But do you know what they say about justice delays? Yvonne brushed a bit of lint off of my shoulder and said, I'll bring you a coffee. This will be a long one. Sorry, I can't do anything about that. Hey, Yvonne, there ought to be a law. With a wink to my clerk, I opened the connecting door with the familiar refrain of, all right. It's called Just to Watch Them Die, Crime Fiction, inspired by the music of Johnny Cash, available from all fine book purveyors.
Very well done, and very well handled with the sound effects, by the way. Handled that much better than I would have. So our next reader is myself. Jeffrey Hess is the author of the novel Beachhead and the story collection Cold War Canoe Club, as well as the editor of the award-winning anthologies Home of the Brave, Stories in Uniform, and Home of the Brave, Somewhere in the Sand. He served 6 years aboard the Navy's oldest and newest ships and has held writing positions at a daily newspaper, a Fortune 500 company, and a university-based research center. He holds an MFA in creative writing from Queen's University of Charlotte, and his writing has appeared widely in print and online. He lives in Florida, here in Tampa, where he leads the DD214 Writers Workshop for Military Veterans. Learn more about Jeffrey Hess at jeffreyhess.com, and that is jeffreyhess.com, or on Twitter at realjeffreyhess, and again, that's J-E-F-F-E-R-Y, or on the About Now Books website as well. So without further ado, let's bring up Jeffrey Hess.
Yes.
Great to be here. Thank you very much. I'm going to read a few pages from my forthcoming novel from Down Out Books. It's a sequel to Beachhead, actually. So this is a first-time announcement of the title of the new book, which is, drumroll, Tush Hog. The first one is Beachhead. This one is Tush Hog. If anybody knows the South, you might know what that means. It's explained in the book. But anyway, it's this setup is a scene from the book which involves, if you remember from Beachhead, Scotland Ross is the protagonist, and this scene takes place involving one of Scotland's friends in the new book. His name is Gator Doug, and Gator's son has run afoul of the same people who threatened him earlier, and so this scene shows how the bad guys have kind of won, at least for now. So this is from Tush Hog. The marina cut a swath of mangroves. I'm sorry, let me start that again. I did this. It's unbelievable. Anyway.
Take two.
Can you edit that out?
No. Yes. Oh. I can, but I won't. I'm lazy. Sorry, you're stuck with it.
The marina cut into a swath of mangroves off the north shore of the Coosahatchee River. It consisted of 50 dormant boats tied to docks. Gator Doug parked and walked along the road closest to the channel. Ripples of diesel-slick water lapped like a fire lawn in the holds of boats. The marina was dark except for the pole lights on each dock. It was quiet except for dogs on opposite sides of the bay that barked back and forth. Barking dogs was the only sounds worse than babies crying. Both were loud and nonstop. The babies had to cry, except for his son, Dougie. He was never a crier as a child, which had been one of his rare gifts. Dougie had made it obvious at a young age he'd never become the next attorney general, but at least he never kept his father up at night. Gator Doug walked toward the docks as if walking barefoot on sizzling asphalt. Sweat dampened his neck. As he walked, the smell of low tide was replaced by the charred smell of wood and meat. It was the wrong weather for a nearby fireplace and the wrong time of day for a barbecue. The smell got stronger the closer he got to the Golden Noble, which was red except for the transom and was scorched black halfway to the waterline. If anybody lived aboard their boat in this marina, they would have seen or heard the fire, smelled the smoke. Maybe anyone who'd been there already ran for the hills or the cops. Gator Doug had no way of knowing how much time he'd have before the cops showed. Cops would bring questions, and there was no time for questions. As he got closer, he saw the outline of someone sitting motionless near the stern. Gator Duck's throat kinked, and he couldn't catch his breath for a moment. He walked closer, leaned over the gunwale. The face was badly burned, but the crooked tooth was unmistakable. A stream of bile rose from Gator Duck's gut, fast enough to make his knees weak. He was in shock, and his legs were locked. He felt like his feet were nailed to the dock with railroad spikes. Yet despite the horror of seeing his son, he couldn't look away. He shook his head. No, he called into the night as he squeezed his eyes shut and clenched around the heaviness in the pit of his stomach. Tears and sweat mixed in the crease of his cheeks. He wiped it away with the tail of his T-shirt. His eyes remained unfocused as he recalled the day he taught Dougie to ride a bike. A catfish flashed ahead of him. Silent on the way out, with impact on re-entry that displaced water loud enough to jar Gator Doug from his memory. Ah, fuck, he said as he kicked a boot into a pylon. Dougie's charred remains were drenched in salt water. The boat and the body had been burned deliberately and hotly, but extinguished before the mooring lines ever felt the heat. Whoever did this didn't want to destroy evidence. They wanted to send a message. As he sat up in the water, he saw a 19-foot bayliner with a torn bimini top. He walked over and boarded it, tugged the ripped canvas. With the help of his pocket knife, he cut a sheet large enough to satisfy his needs. He climbed back onto the dock and spread it there before boarding the burned boat. Water sloshed on the charred deck that felt spongy beneath his footfalls. This close, a bullet hole in the forehead was the size of a .38 on the way in. He walked up to his son and found a wallet, unburned and tucked into a crevice of charred meat between two of Dougie's ribs. Gator Doug pulled it out, opened it to see the Florida driver's license picture of his son, smiling back at him with that crooked tooth. Gator Doug scooped up his son with one arm under the bend of his knees and the other just below his shoulders. His salt water soaked clothes and a smell of burned flesh threatened to make Gator Doug vomit as he wrestled his son's charred corpse onto the dock. One leg dangled over the edge as the boat drifted wide on its moorings. Gator Doug gripped his son's burned foot and heaved the leg onto the dock. His heart pounded from the effort, and a foreign compulsion to cry overtook him. He ignored both as best he could and climbed out of the burned boat and dragged Dougie into position on the scrap of canvas. He bent down again and rolled Dougie like the world's biggest joint. He wished he had one now to make this bearable. Gator Doug squatted as deep as a sumo wrestler as he heaved the wrapped corpse over his shoulder. The last time he carried his son was 20 years ago, and though Dougie wasn't very big, he was heavy the way churches are heavy.
Weekly. This is a huge fan deal.
Maybe you're just an all around soul person. So let's welcome Jeff O.
Hey, Jeff!
I'm really bad on microphones, so can you hear me? Okay, I get like the teacher voice and I get really loud sometimes. If it's too loud, just let me know. Wave at me. I am going to be reading from Walk in the Fire. Lightwood is for sale here, but Walk in the Fire is the sequel to the trilogy. It will be out January 16th. It did just get the Star and Publishers Weekly, which is pretty exciting. Just to give you a little bit of background about the series before I jump right into reading, an action scene, which is very different for me. Normally I read conversations and it's deep and brooding, and I kind of said, what the hell, I'm going to read about two chicks beating up a guy. So, that's going to work. So, Lightwood and Walk in the Fire is a story about the Cannon family clan. They are from North Central Florida. If you're from Florida, if you've ever driven up 301 to Stark, that's the area that this takes place. It takes place in Bradford County. Lightwood also deals with a Pentecostal preacher slash mob crime boss, Mr. Tula, and the Scorpions, who's a motorcycle gang. We've got the sound effects going too. Lightwood is about these three groups: the Cannon family, crime family, Sister Tula, who is ruling her congregation and the town of nearby Kentville, and the Scorpion motorcycle gang. Oh, we got this all kind of going on here. I'm waiting for something to just come buzzing by here. So I'm not going to give too much of Lightwood away. It is for sale here. Walk in the Fire takes place 3 months directly after the story. It's the same group of characters. Some of them are obviously not in the book because some of them didn't make it. You have to read Lightwood to find out. But the characters I'm going to be reading about tonight are Rainey Barrow, who is one of my favorites. She is the, if my ADD is getting a little distracted, focus. She is the girlfriend of Judith Cannon. She's a soul that kind of does her own thing. She's got sucked into this crime family. The scene is also going to be involving Sheila, who is one of those characters that started off as a very minor girl in a bar character, and by the time we get to Walk in the Fire, she has emerged as a main character. And I love it when that happens. I love it when a character that's very just sort of on the sidelines takes over. The background of this scene, I'm losing my tongue. The background of this scene is, this is near the end of the novel, so I'm trying to figure out how to not give too much away. I don't ever plan my readings. So I just kind of picked this scene about 5 minutes ago. The background is, there is the sort of big bad of this story is a man named Everett Weaver. He is a drug runner out of Daytona, Florida, and he has threatened the Cannon family. He has also just recently murdered a whole lot of people in a bar, which I'm not going to tell you who. I'm trying to, like, keep the mystery there. So basically, when this scene takes place, we have Rainey Barrow and Sheila, who have teamed up, the two girls of the story, have teamed up to take on Everett Weaver, the psychotic, big, bad drug runner. And our setting is a diner. It's close to a bar, so we can kind of go with the music. It's a little bit diner-ish. And there are two really short back-to-back scenes. The first one is Sheila's point of view. Because we go immediately, no change in time, to Rainey's point of view. Kind of a short, sweet two scenes back to back. That was a big encompassing of everything right there with noise going on, so I went in for that. Okay, so this is Sheila. She's just walked into the bar and has decided that she is going to try and seduce Everett Weaver with the plans on then later, you know, killing him. Sheila didn't give herself time to think twice. She was vaguely aware that the two men at the far end of the counter had raised their heads at the sound of the bell on the door tinkling, but she didn't look in their direction. Nor did she glance at Kathy, standing behind the counter, flipping eggs on the flat-top grill. The only person Sheila had eyes for was Weaver, and he hadn't bothered to look up. Sheila tugged at her skirt and pushed out her chest before sitting down on the empty vinyl stool next to his. She leaned her elbow on the filmy counter and ran her fingers quickly through her hair. Her heart leapt up in her throat, threatening to her, as Weaver slowly turned to face her. His voice was low and guttural. "You decide to save me the trouble of hunting you down?" Sheila had spent most of her life charming men, and at this point, instead of allowing herself to consider what she was actually doing, she let instinct take over. Sheila popped her eyes wider and smiled, her lips curling upward in a sultry promise. "You wouldn't actually hurt me, would you?" Weaver's expression didn't change. "You have no idea what I'm going to do to you." Sheila's eyes flitted away to the counter and then back up at Weaver. She kept that same smile on her lips. "Well, what if I offered you something better? Better than watching the light fade from your eyes?" Sheila kept up the one-sided game. Her only hope was that Weaver really did think she was as dumb as she looked. "Could be better. I know a lot of fellas who think it's a pretty good time." Weaver laughed loudly and brought his palm crashing down on the counter, rattling the silverware set up. Cassie turned with a plate in one hand and gave him a reproachful look before setting the eggs and bacon down in front of the man wearing a baseball cap. Sheila watched the ripple of determination pass over Weaver's face and knew that she had only seconds to snap his attention back to her. She needed to make the promise of this. Oh, here we go, more sound. There's no motorcycles in this one, though. She didn't make the promise of her death more appealing than Cassie. Sheila laid her fingers lightly on Weaver's gaunt, hairy wrist. "How about I make you a deal, sugar? How about we go on back to the dawn and I make you feel better than you ever felt?" Weaver's frosty blue eyes darted back to her. "What the hell are you talking about?" He hadn't pushed her away, though, so maybe he was considering the possibility. Maybe he believed he was stupid enough to think that she could make a bargain for her life. Here she was, offering herself up, bandy to be slaughtered, and she'd even let him knock her off somewhere where it wouldn't make too much of a mess. Weaver could kill her quietly and then come back out and figure out how to take the mom and the kids. Sheila raked her nails lightly over the back of his hand. "Come on, come on, you had to go for it. You know what I'm talking about." Sheila lowered her eyes flirtatiously and started to get up from the stool. Weaver suddenly had her wrist gripped in his hand, and it was all Sheila could do not to gasp. He jerked her closer to him. "All right, sweetheart, let's see what you've got." He let go of her bruised wrist and stood up. Sheila quickly glanced around the diner. No one was giving them a questioning look. If anything, they probably thought she was just another lot lizard making a quick buck. Weaver was ahead of her, and Sheila noticed with a wry smile that he was favoring one leg, stabbed him earlier in the book. Just beyond the cash register was a short hallway leading back to the kitchen and single bathroom, and Weaver disappeared around the corner of it. Sheila brushed her hand against the side of her skirt, feeling for the tiny penknife she had jammed into the narrow denim pocket. It was useless, but reassuring. She came around the corner trying to calculate how much time she had, how much longer she could keep it going. Weaver had her by the throat before she could even work it out. In one rapid movement, he had her up against the wall of the dim hallway, one hand over her mouth, the other squeezing her windpipe. She was out of time. Weaver brought his face close to hers, and Sheila stared up into the beast behind his eyes and was no longer afraid. Ever since she was 16 years old, Sheila had known that she would die this way, at the hands of a man who was looking down at her with hatred or disgust, at a man who thought he had power over her and wanted her to know it. But she did not know it, did not believe it, and never would. Even in her last moment of breath, Sheila knew that she held all the cards. We're going to jump directly to the next scene, which is Rainey walking right in the diner. I'm getting a little action-y now. That was the kind of brooding setup. Rainey had been trying to keep her back to the diner's window, but the moment she caught a glance of Sheila disappearing down the hallway behind Weaver, she spun and bolted through the front door. The bell jangled. furiously, but Rainey didn't bother to silence it. She went straight to the counter and leaned over, frantically waving at Cassie to come to her. Cassie wearily set down the coffee pot in her hand and approached Rainey, glancing back and shrugging to the men at the other end of the counter. Can I help you? Rainey grabbed Cassie's shoulder and pulled the woman to her so she could whisper loudly in her ear, "Get your kid and get the hell out of here now." Cassie was struggling against her. "What the now?" Rainey shoved her back and yanked the gun out of the back of her jeans. Everyone around her froze at the sight, except for the little girl standing in the center of the diner with a bright green stuffed alligator fixed up under her arm. Stella didn't freeze. Stella screamed at the top of her six-year-old lungs, and Rainey lurched into motion. There was no chance of surprise now. She just had to get Weaver as soon as possible. Rainey careened around the corner of the hallway, only to come face-to-face with Weaver and the very struggling Sheila in his grip. She raised the 9mm and fired. I'm going to end there because I don't want to give away what happened.
Get a
hanging
on that. That's great.
All right, so last but not least, we have Eric Pruitt. Eric Pruitt is a screenwriter, author, and filmmaker. He wrote and produced the short film Booty, which went on to win 8 Cup Awards at over 16 film festivals. His short fiction has appeared in the Avalon Literary Review, Thug Lit, Pulp Modern, and Zimbal, among others. And he is a finalist for the Derringer Award. He is the author of the novels Dirtbags and Hashtag. He is the host of the monthly radio show and podcast, The Crime Scene, with Eric Pruitt. He lives in Durham, North Carolina, with his wife, Lana, and their cat, Busey. Follow him at Reverend Eric, and that's Eric, E-R-Y-K. So let's give it up for Eric Pruitt. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's been really, it's been a lot of fun coming out here to Florida. I was told there was going to be a mess. But I'm from Texas.
It's early yet.
Yeah, that comes later.
There you go.
I'm from Texas, which I have a lot to do with the story. I'm going to read here. By the way, my book that just came out is called What We Reckon, and Eric from Down and Out, was very, very kind and bought some to sell here, so please pay it back and put those up. But I'm going to read something different. This is called Knacker. And like I said, I'm from Texas. This story is about a Texan who is finds himself homeless in Ireland after a vacation. Knackers, if you don't know, is like what the Irish call hobos. They have these things over there called knacker fights, which is it's highly illegal, but it's basically like enemies of hobos fighting each other. And it's even illegal to own one. If you even have a knacker fight DVD, you can go to jail. So our Texan gets caught up in a knacker fight ring, and eventually he's going to end up fighting the famous, infamous knacker fighter, Baldy. And that's where this story is going to pick up. So this is knacker. Some things you can't never get used to. Like how it could rain on a sunny day in Ireland and there not be a cloud in the sky. The entire ride down to Wicklow, I pressed my face to the glass in absolute marvel to watch the downpour and reckon from where all it came. The chocolate treats of a creamy Guinness sliding down the gullet. The slap on the nose from malt vinegar poured into a bag of fries, more likely chips. The brace of hash mixed with shit tobacco in the dirty sear scratches against the tonsils. And ever more their language. Yes. The words shed forth from young men such as my traveling companions, Mike, Park, and Nathan, and their life was pure delight, arrested from the tired, lazy euphemisms of my own dull culture. For instance, instead of balls, they said bollocks. Instead of whacking off, it is called tossing. One who's never tired, he got knackered. And there's a million ways to say you're drunk. Cigarettes are fatty. Anybody brown is a packy, and everywhere you look, there's a ton. Cunts. Your friends are cunts. Your enemies are cunts. Strangers even are cunts. You refer to an old man as that age-old cunt. And a youngster? A cunt, yes. Women are taught, sure, but most likely it's better to call one to a man. A slow guy, a fast guy, a skinny fella, or a fat one. Your parents, they're cunts. Your guard, you bet your aunt's a guard, a cunt. The priest, the barman, the French dude on a bicycle, that big cunt, this weak cunt, all of them. Cunt, 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 cunt. Cunt. And instead of traveling by foot, they leg it. Mike said we leg it from the bus stop to the warehouse, and we did, taking a good 15 minutes to get there. Walking up and down suburban streets until we come to the most unimposing of structures, a storage facility. Any and all walls inside that building had been torn asunder, leaving one long warehouse, dark and dusty. What scant light there was came from two twin bulbs on lamps set in the middle of the room and left plenty of space for shadows. And among those shadows operated one of the shortest men in all of Ireland, shirt sleeves. Shirt rolled near to his elbows as he barked orders to a gaggle of bedraggled hobos. The poor wretches stood shirtless and surly in yonder corner and looked not to know what to make of the little fellow before him. He paused mid-harangue to remark our entry, and his eyes like to pop out of his head. "Say, just Mike," he said as he approached. "You're not fucking huge." Two fat men in bowler hats sat in chairs along a far wall. They nodded my direction and exchanged whispered shit talk. "And he's really Texan?" "Well, come look at his boots, will ya?" "He did, but was yet to be sold." "How do I know you're not having me on? Flap a pair of boots on a biffle." "What's a biffle?" I asked. Said the mall. "Big ignorant fucker from Offaly." "We're not the type to have you on, not her." Mike slipped an arm around my neck. Instead, I brought his ever upward. "Dick, my boy, why don't you share with Nutter here your thoughts on the Irish?" "As a whole?" I asked him. "But I got no real will towards you people. Way I heard it, you folks had just as much issue as we did with the British. And you earned your way into my heart when 12 or so of you had fought and died at the Alamo. I think it's a horrible shame the way you were treated building railroads across America, and I believe it's damn near impossible to hate a group of people with so many innovative and inventive ways to handle a potato." Nodder stepped in a circle around me, sizing me up as he went. Dollar signs river danced from those beady little eyes of his. He bit his lip. I pointed to the crowd of younger hobos and asked, "Which one of them over there is Baldy? Have you not seen a photo of Baldy?" I shook my head. That expression on his face turned out to be a smile. He said, "Baldy will arrive shortly. You're not main event, mate." I shrugged it off. "All this flattery is going to turn me soft," I told him. "Perhaps it's best if I go stand amongst the hobos, remind myself what it was once like to be hungry. If I don't warn ahead, I'd have tipped it." Instead, I swaggered off toward the hobos, my people. Why not long ago we'd have battled each other for a warm, dry doorway under which to lay our heads. Race the setting sun to that spot below the steps on Lower Leeson, or perhaps the patio table at the joint down by the canal. Dumped one another over the wall, surrounding the green. Or ran port for an outfit, nicking tips from the hats and guitar cases of busters along drafted. I reminded myself, it was only yesterday that I, too, had awoken in the gutter. "Hey," I told him, "my name's Deke." "Now, we know who you are," said the short one up front. "You're a yank with a space age sleeping bag." "I told you hobos plenty times before," I snarled. "I ain't a yank. I'm a Texan." "That's right," said another. "You're the dumpy cocker from Texas, and I'm playing those boots off you with all these guns with the likes of you." "I can take any man on this island," I said. "I stand a good two or three heads taller than Hawaii. What the hell's that all about? Some of these bastards out here I gotta step out of just to turn around. I ain't sure if it's all the potatoes to blame or because you turned a drink so early, but I'll have no problem licking any one of you hobos and making sure you stay licked." The bums swapped glances with each other. Then the meanest one, he turned to me and said, "So you've never seen a picture of Baldy, have you?" "Hey, what's the big deal? Is he a big guy?" And they fell into laughter, which sent me straight to fidget. I puffed up my chest and arched my back and lit into them. I threw a finger to their faces. "Laugh all you want. But ain't a single one of you what they call a moneymaker. They got all kinds of notions that I can break records when it comes to selling Knacker Fight DVDs. If folks want to see an asshole get beat on, maybe they found out a bit late and think the Texan to see it done, but they found out all the same, and you jackoffs will find out you're out of a job once again." I shuddered any and all thoughts they had about throwing further shame my way, so I rest my case and took my leave. Nearly slammed into Parry, who had the camcorder pointing my direction. "State your name, mate." "Come on. I've been thinking about that," I told him. What would you say about a nickname?" "A nickname? Yeah, something flashy like Death Out of Dallas or the Texas Tornado." Hard lowered the camera. "Perhaps it's best if you state your full name and where you're from," vindicated, should anything unfortunate have upheaval take place. I promised I would, but shortly thereafter settled in to watch the fight. Leaning against the wall alongside Mike as the other two knackers stepped to the center of the room near the twin lamps and went at it. All the while, Park kept the camera pointed at the fighters, never taking the lens off them. Not when some asshole from court split the cheek of a skinny kid out of Dublin. Not when some redhead broke his hand over the nose of a Kerryborn fella. And not when they wheeled in a British guy. Then an angry boyo from the north had to be pulled off him after breaking both the lineman's arms. Never once did he take the camera off the action in the center of the room, not to let run out of all the fighters, and he turned that sucker again my direction. Your turn, Deke. I looked around, said, yeah, but where's Baldy? He answered my question. All the air stuff clean out of the room. Holy. He was flanked by six guys in black t-shirts, muscular guys who walked on the balls of their feet so as to keep it ready. He was a big man, a good 3-4 heads over the rest of his countrymen, all of them one bulging muscle. His head shaved clean, but shaved with something dull and rusty, as it was nothing but a ride on Nixon's streets. With each lumbering football, he let fire a yelp, hollow yelp, as if he were some lunatic drill sergeant or a rabid mental patient. Likely the latter, because so crazy was he, only 1 hour. The other lolled and set to wonder while the good one burned hellfire. So insane, he marked up every inch of himself with jailhouse tattoos from stem to stern, and even some up the length of his neck. So batshit nuts was this guy that he held in one hand a half-drank pint of pissy ale, and in the other, well, in the other, he held a leather strap tethered to a chimpanzee. A chimpanzee. Not a wee monkey, but a damn near giant, a mere head shorter than his master keeper. He had hair bristled as Brillo pads. He had shoulders broad as a pinto. He had the temper of 1,000 angry hornets, a deep, the size of my action finger. It followed its keeper at the length of a black leather strap. Then, silence. All felt quiet as the big man halted his terrible march and turned that mess of the head like a turret to face me. That good wild eye, it is like a pump of conflagration. That grin like a junkie. That inked up sausage of a finger pointing my way. Dear Christ, I managed. Is that Baldy? Behind him, the chimp had yet to notice his keeper's march and stop. So preoccupied had it been with this, that, and the other, that it walked slowly into the back of him, and that pint of beer sloshed across the chimpanzee's thick fur. You could have heard it known for it, and then he couldn't. Because up came a fury in that chimpanzee as it let fly a terrible frenzy, drowning that warehouse with a high-pitched wail of a great protest, then the dull thudding of its mighty fist as he worked to beat the meat off his keeper's face. The big guy's black teeth had jumped to action. One tried to take him high while the other went for the chimp's knees. Neither made it, only to be stopped by the monkey's vise-like grip before he cast him aside with little thought. That's when the two others make their move. One with an electric cattle prod, which was quickly snatched by the chimpanzee, and he broke it over his knee. The other with a snare pole, and he struggled like mad to sniff the noose around the neck of the chimp, while the other two wrestled it mightily to the ground. No, mate, said Mike. That's Baldy. Not a word for me as my jaw hung limp as a weary pecker. In fact, in the whole little warehouse, all could be heard was a piteous moan from the monkey's keeper as the boy on the black shirt dragged his broken body to safety. Said I ain't fucking Baldy, guys. Now's your chance, man, said Nodder. You've bought from scrapping with the lion. No, I'm not fighting the monkey. If it's any consolation, said Nathan, it won't be much of a fight. I repeated myself, then again with more volume. Michael slipped his arm around me. That's not as bad as you think. The best part is you'll be unconscious for the majority of it. A night, 3 weeks later, when you wake, you'll be 100-year-old richer. I thought you said it's 80-year-old. Turns out, said Mike, a lot of people will pay good quid to see a yank if you don't buy a chimpanzee. The monkey finally had been restrained. They led him by snare poles to the center of the room. Look at it this way. Nathan nodded to the fat cat with bowler hat sitting in the shadows against the far wall. You really think those rich folks will let you out of the warehouse without fighting a monkey? Nodder shoved me further to the center of the room, closer still to the monkey. Try to get a couple of licks in if you can. Baldy no longer struggled against the restraints, no longer set fury to heaven. The only sounds from the beast were the labored rhythm of the angry breaths. His chest and shoulder heaved, but nothing else bothered to move. His feet remained planted. His fist kept tall, and his eyes never wavered from me. What is your name? Whispered Pard. This camera lay in the double inside. I took a deep breath. My name is Deacon Easter, I told him, and I'm from Dallas, Texas. And my mother's name is, that's the last of it I remember. Like many nights of a terrible bender, I lost it all to the agents, because after that, I had to find out everything else by watching it on DVD, just like the rest of Ireland. Thank you very much for the feedback.
As the host of this show, it is very rare that I have heard a reading quite like that, quite poetic, and now I've got to go back and edit the fucking thing to say X-rated. Thank you.
So that's our show for the evening. That was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
Thanks for being with us tonight, folks. Have a great evening.
Thank you, everybody, for coming out. Especially Eric, to travel all the way from